It is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David, of course, joins us every Friday morning here on Robinhood Radio. Now, you can also find his commentary at robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. But on top of all that, we're just a sidebar in David's life because he's got so many other things going on. He's a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. He also has postings in Huffington Post and also, yeah, his own website, themediabeat.us. Good morning, David.
Well, good morning. Can I say happy new 2018?
Yeah, it is 2018, and we're
starting. Are you happy?
Well, I'd be happier if we didn't have such horrible weather.
Yeah, it is. The year begins with a real snap of winter, doesn't it?
It's amazing.
More so for you than for me in the media capital of the world. Although we've had nearly a foot of snow in the city, too. Not as bad and not as cold as you, but we've got our taste of winter.
You know what gets me about the taste of winter? And this happened about 4 years ago when we had the Arctic outbreaks, and all of a sudden everything was called a polar vortex, okay?
And the word of the season
is bombo cyclone, but and yeah. That's not even really
the word bombs coming up in the weather forecast.
Yeah. What we've always known, if you follow the weather, especially in New England in the wintertime, storms, once they get off the East Coast, if they follow a certain benchmark, it's a benchmark along the East Coast, which takes it over Cape Cod, storms go through a thing called bombogenesis, which means that they literally explode. That's been a term that's been around forever, and it's been a nice term. It explained. No one now it's overused. It was
it's grown out of meteorologists' techno speak. It's not very. It hasn't got a great history in terms of English etymology, but you know, bombolescence and bombogenesis are nice words for meteorologists to get their head and their lips around.
But now everybody's using them.
But they're common enough. They're certainly common enough.
Yep, it's unbelievable. Well, anyway, we're not going to bomb here in the first show of 2018, though.
Yeah.
We never bomb.
We don't bomb. But somebody called me from California, and they were just like, oh, there's this thing. It's a bomb cyclone. And I was like, oh, please.
Yes.
Yeah, can you get...
Meteorologists were all just shaking their heads, too, saying, we thought we were the only nerds that used these terms.
Bomb cyclone explodes.
Right. Well, actually, it's an interesting use of the development of a slang word from progressing through science. I mean, it's an attempt to describe an explosive creation of a cyclone. But of course, bombs don't mean necessarily the creation of anything to us in the general public, do they? That's almost an inversion of the word. It's explosive, but it's explosive in creating something, not in destroying something.
Right, except if you're...
Interesting bit of vocabulary development.
Except if you, of course, are in the Broadway showbiz.
Right, yeah.
Or just regular showbiz, in fact.
I have a question for both of you.
Go ahead.
The public relations guy for this book, he can retire.
You mean the Michael Wolff book? The bomb?
Forget about the book itself. Whoever planned on releasing
Fire and Fury is a pretty explosive name, too, for a book. Huh?
They just...
what are the publishers saying?
That person should retire, whoever figured out how to promote it just by releasing, once again, a few of those juicy clips, whether they're true or not, because... It's an absolute phenomenon. It's just, that's the society we live in.
I know, and what's so great about the society we live in is that, you know, in the end, because people are focused on that, this is going to be just such a great way to get them to spend all their profits.
Well, here's the whole thing, though. It's so funny. They release the excerpts.
Right.
And then the personal attorneys say cease and desist. Then they see that it goes up to number one on the Amazon list in pre-order. So then they say, well, you know what? We're moving up the deadline by 4 days.
Yeah, they'll just release it. But what is amazing, if you had been on the receiving end of the requests of the stuff that they want. This is the sort of thing. Marshall is the one who has to do our grant work, and you know, he has to sit and provide backup and stuff. Oh dear God, it's just. So it's got nothing to do with the public.
But they're going to just make a ton of money. As much money as they spend on lawyers' fees, it'll be a good investment in promoting the book.
Oh, sure. There's no better.
There's no better thing than saying no.
There's no better tool for publicizing a book than to provoke a cease and desist letter.
It's funny because
three days before
my second
you're going to publish.
My second full-time job in radio, I was in an airplane and I said something over somebody's house who had appeared in Hustler magazine, and I said, "This is where so and so lives." And I got back to the station the next day, and I'm sitting with John Baturi, the program director, and a lawyer comes in, and he wants to sue because I pointed out where she lived. And I didn't know what to say, and John Baturi goes, "His name is Marshall Miles, MARSHALLMILES. He works for WKNY, and make sure you spell everything correctly."
Right.
and we love these cease and desist letters.
If you are old enough, you understand that the best way to create, any interest whatsoever is to
get a cease and desist order.
Either that, or
of course, prized possession. Wear it like a medal.
But we also used to. This is a music business thing. You know, best way to create interest in someone who you couldn't get arrested was to park a bunch of cars outside a gig, put a sign that said "sold out."
So,
and again, the same thing holds true for business. Though the other day, people were having trouble because, as you know, in the last 20 years, certain businesses think that just fulfilling orders is all they really need to do to remain viable. And it, in quotes, used to be that what was necessary was to have a sense of your market and what you were going to need when. And some years you worked well, and some years you just ate tuna fish because you didn't. And
sure,
that whole sense of length and context and how to create interest it now looks to people as though, oh, well, all I have to do is just tell people that I'm doing this. And it's sometimes not quite as easy as it looks.
Right. Nothing is as easy as it looks. Promoting a book like Michael Wolff's book, current book, is not easy, but they've had it made easier for them, Henry Holt, the publishers, by the response of the White House, and indeed many of the people who allegedly gave quotes to the author, Michael Wolff, and who have been, of course, disputing the fact that they ever gave those quotes. It ought to be said that Michael Wolff has a somewhat unconventional approach to recording quotes and citing them in his work. Michael Wolff is a controversial journalist. I think that's the simplest way I can put it. I'm not making any judgment on the quality of the book. I haven't seen it yet, and all I've seen is the excerpts initially in The Guardian and New York Magazine. But of course, there's been a hell of a lot more come out as the publishers very sensibly have been spoon feeding a little bit more each day, and now of course brought the actual publishing day right forward, right up to today itself. I think it'll be available in bookstores, and they can sell it. I mean, they've had it available for several days now, but the official on sale date was meant to be next Tuesday, and now they're available right now. But just based on those little excerpts that we've been getting, I can see that it's very much in the tradition of Michael Wolff's work. Michael Wolff doesn't tend to require two sources for anything that he states as a fact. He's known for his what he calls his sense of the sense of the occasion, rather than detailed matter of fact. And it's interesting also the fact that he was able to do it in the first place, that, you know, he was allowed into the White House to gather all these tidbits that he's managed to pull together into this book. I know there's a great quote from David Carr. David Carr, the media columnist for the New York Times, who died. Oh boy, now it's 3 years
ago. 3 years, it's a lot.
3 years since we lost David Carr. Yeah. And I don't want to sort of try and create the impression that there's a sort of clubby association of media critics, but we do talk to each other. David Carr was quite a close friend of mine, and he had interesting things to say about Michael Wolff. He said that, you know, you've got to ask the question all the time about Michael, is why do people invite him in? And what was the phrase he used? Even sometimes let him into your circle, which is rather like putting a hungry ferret down your own trousers.
Yeah. And it's funny.
The reason that, you know, Michael Wolff makes a particular point of not being liked. I mean, and David used to say that, you know, that can be attributed by some people to him being a psychopath. I think of it more as a business strategy. And Michael has done that throughout his career. He's fearless, and that's what prompted David to say that there was a strain of sociopathy. But it, you know, as he said, it does make good business sense too. He doesn't care what he says, and sometimes I suspect he doesn't care too much about the grounding and the your checkability of his quotes. They're often secondhand, thirdhand. He cherishes the cocktail party circuit as a source. It's almost like crowdsourcing his material. So I think we just have to, you know, keep a large pinch of salt available as we read this book. But of course, you know, the sheer volume and we know just plain common sense suggests to us that a lot of what he says in this book is true. It's just hard to know which particular bits are true and which particular bits are not.
And in this current, let's say, culture, since people like to choose their own truth, you know, there will be plenty of that. We are adding a little element to the Media Beat this year, going forward, which is things that really should be mentioned. But just, hello, because there's
rather than just always giving thumbs down. You mean? Yeah.
Well, and also, one loses the sense that there's anything else going on.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Because the book, can you believe this? The book. And I was not entirely trapped, but I was at home yesterday, which meant that I had the TV on more than usual. You know, so it was looking at... It was mostly on local news. I didn't dare go on to cable news, but it was just regular local news. And, you know, trying to fill time making a snowstorm interesting.
Yeah, while it's going on too.
Yeah.
If you, you know, stick a lens out of a window and
oh look, there's
what
a dog.
Will you get?
Right.
Oh,
so
there's an awful lot of gray white stuff out there.
Yeah. So it just highlighted the problem of it's twofold. The person who is in front of the camera has to, you know, be interesting, which is always, everybody's been to parties with people who are trying to be interesting, and the people who are watching lose any sense whatsoever. And this is the wonder of screens, that there's a world out there that's past the size of what, you know, that screen. It's a magical, magical thing. So how could you know that there's anything else going on? And that's why we are going to choose something. Actually, we aren't. You are.
Well, I'm always on the lookout for best practices, is what we used to call it at the United Nations. I know it's a term that's become something of a cliche in the business world, as well as the non-profit and non-governmental organization, you know, the NGO world as well. But best practice is probably a good way of describing it. I mean, media critics, myself included, spend a lot of our time just decrying what's wrong with the media. But I think it is a good idea that we should look every now and again, maybe every week, for something that exemplifies what is good about the media. Sometimes you come across some prime examples of the sort of journalism which gives our trade a good name, instead of always picking on the stuff that gives us a bad name and decrying it. I don't shy away from the word best practice either, because I mean, if people follow this as a model, then maybe it's a chance for every journalist to improve, you know, up their game a bit. And what I've chosen this week is an interesting. It's a site, and I mean, it's a particular story well done at that site. But it's typical of the site itself, and I really think it deserves props. It's a site that gets a reasonable number of hits. It's not up in the it's not
in
up
the zillions. In the, it's not in the
no
in
no,
the
and it's not
fire
even
and
in the
fury
Drudge,
realm.
It's not even in the Drudge Report league either. But it's very respectable, and it's a good solid piece of journalistic work. It's called Live Science, and as its name suggests, it has a particular field that it concentrates on. But it does so with that good journalistic approach of making the whole area of, indeed in their world, mainly life sciences, really palatable in a journalistic sense too. It has some intriguing origins, which it's hard to describe. I don't want to be overly negative about it, but it didn't have a particularly propitious start. It was a spin-off from the possibly more well-known site space.com, which I don't know if you recall, but back in 1999, Lou Dobbs.
That's the
oddly.
I know. What happened?
I don't know quite why he is like this, but he sort of moved from being a very straightforward financial journalist into being a decidedly opinionated right-wing so-called analyst while he worked at CNN. He had two run-ins with CNN management and two different presidents of the company. And even named one of them on air, saying that this man is making a crazy decision. He wants me to cover this and not what I want to cover, but we're going to cover it because President Rick Kaplan, it was, is making me do it. That's a good way to stay popular with your own boss, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's what
anyway,
I say. I'm
they,
quitting.
They parted company. and what he did was form this site, space.com, because he happens to be, amongst his many intriguing characteristics, something of a space nerd. And you know, even though, you know, people have the opportunity of going to a much bigger, you know, more sizably funded and publicly funded site, NASA's own site, there was spunky little space.com competing with it and did rather well. I mean, there's a very good and strong market for information amongst space nerds, and it did very well. And got advertising increased its click rate enormously, giving issue in the end to the development of Live Science, which is a terrific little site and owes little, many changes of ownership in the meantime, but owes little to Lou Dobbs anymore. And that's probably, not to be unkind, but that's probably to its benefit. It's very good, straightforward journalism about science. And the story of the week for me from them is something that should be of vast interest to those of us who are not necessarily scientifically minded, but nonetheless care about vital issues. Here's the headline. I think it's pretty pretty good, journalistically speaking, good headline too, with one of those really probing questions that we do, that does demand an answer. It says, the headline is, "Can gene editing save the world's chocolate?" Those of us who have a certain penchant for chocolate might be affected by that title, and a lot of people anyway, just because it's such a pokey kind of idea. It pokes and it gets your attention. We know about fungi and parasites and the like that are troubling many crops in the world, like oranges in Florida, for instance. But it may not be so well known that fungi and viruses are really in severe danger of endanger. Well, they are already endangering the world's chocolate crop, the cacao tree, and the cacao bean is showing signs of being horribly affected by one particular fungus and a couple of nasty viruses too. But what's happening now, and this is the journalism that I want to hail here from livescience.com. They've identified a set of research which has been set up, not too surprisingly, but with funding from chocolate company, Mars Inc., but also the Innovative Genomics Institute, which is which is a California academic institute. It's basically an amalgamation of Berkeley and the University of California, San Francisco. And their scientists are basically attempting to engineer new kinds of trees that are going to be resistant to the fungi and the viruses.
Yeah.
And their main tool is that extraordinarily versatile tool that sits in the hands now of genetic scientists, the CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R, and its full name really is CRISPR-Cas9, which basically is an editing machine. It takes you can identify the DNA of whatever creature or plant you're dealing with, and get right down to the sort of fundamentals of life, and get to the chromosomes, and actually edit out the genetic particle which is causing the predisposition to these diseases having an effect, and substituting for it a genetic structure which will encourage immunity. And this is one of those interesting stories that we'll have to say wait and see about the results. But it takes 5 years, for instance, for a cacao tree to get to maturity.
But you know what it does.
So you won't know for some time whether it's working or not. But all the signs are good.
And the other thing that's just amazing about it, and we're out of time, is just it just causes your brain to start thinking about something else for a second. Wouldn't that be good? Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.
Thank you.
And, of course, you can hear The Media Beat here on Robinhood Radio live on Fridays. We broadcast during the week and also on the weekend. But you can also get it online, robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on The Media Beat.